Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Melanoma is 20 to 30 times more common among whites than blacks in the U.S., but the potentially deadly skin cancer presents differently in blacks, and sunscreen doesn't help. Ade Adamson is a board-certified dermatologist and assistant professor of internal medicine at the University of Texas at Austin. He recently wrote about the issue for The Conversation. We'll post a link to the article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why is melanoma more common for whites?
Part of the reason why is because folks that identify as white have less melanin, and melanin is the molecule and the pigment that makes certain people darker, and if you have less of it, it makes you lighter, i.e. white. And it serves as a way to protect the skin from the damaging UV rays from the sun.
So that then follows that melanoma is a function of exposure to UV rays.
So the strongest risk factor, or one of the strongest risk factors for developing melanoma, is sun exposure. But that's mostly the case if you have a lot less melanin.
And you write that melanoma in people who are black is not associated with UV exposure. Why the difference?
So there has never been a conclusive study that has shown that there is a true association between the amount of UV exposure that you get if you identify as black or as of color versus if you're white. That there's never actually been a study that's shown that association at all. And part of the reason why is, one, perhaps maybe there are just less studies in those populations. Mm-hmm. But two is that the intrinsic photoprotective nature of having more melanin protects folks of darker skin types from developing this deadly disease.
Is that true across the universe of skin cancers?
Yeah, so even if you look at the incidence or the amount of melanoma in particular across skin types, it is more prevalent in white people versus Hispanics or Asians or black people. And now if you take the continuum of skin cancers, mm-hmm. so commonly they're called non-melanoma skin cancers being the most common kind of skin cancers. Those are basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. Mm-hmm. Those two are way less common in black people or people that don't identify as white.
Hispanic, right.
Asian.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the issue is that 20 to 30% more. It's more common to have melanoma among whites than blacks in the U.S. But blacks do get melanoma. Famously, Bob Marley, the great musician, died of melanoma, and it was discovered under a toenail.
Exactly. So when folks of color, say blacks and Hispanics, get melanoma, the most common site are on the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet, and that includes under the nails. And those are called acral melanomas. And they can be particularly aggressive, particularly if they're caught later in their development.
And acral melanomas, do we know the incidence of that in whites?
Yeah, so one misconception is that acral melanomas are more common in blacks than they are in whites. Mm-hmm. They're actually equally as frequent. But the difference is, more often than not, those appear in black people than white people, because white folks have more melanomas than all other parts of the body.
All right, and so is the acral melanoma associated with UV exposure?
It is not.
Okay.
It is not. So I would ask you anyone mm-hmm. in the audience when the last time it was, regardless of race, that they had a sunburn on the palms of their hands or the soles of their feet.
Right. And public health agencies routinely recommend sunscreen for prevention, but they don't distinguish when it comes to race or ethnicity.
They don't, and I think that has to change. And I think one of the reasons why they don't do that, because they feel as though if they start targeting different populations with different messages, some people may get confused and, you know, say somebody that might be at risk might not benefit from this potential intervention of, you know, wearing sunscreen.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Ade Adamson. He's a board-certified dermatologist, assistant professor of internal medicine at the University of Texas at Austin. He wrote an article for The Conversation. We'll post it to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. It was about the issue of melanoma. It's 20 to 30 times more common among whites and blacks, but It does exist for people of color, and it presents differently. Sunscreen doesn't help. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is it still bad for somebody with a lot of melanin in their skin, somebody who's black, Hispanic, non-white in general, is it safer for them to go without sunscreen?
So I would say that sun protection by the use of sunscreen or staying out of the sun, using long sleeves, has more benefits beyond skin cancer prevention, right? Sunburns can be prevented by using sunscreens, and that's, you know, a benefit. The aging process is also accelerated by continuous exposure to UV, and sunscreen can help with that. And certain people are just sensitive to the sun or have disorders that make them sensitive to the sun, and wearing sunscreen would be important in those areas as well. And so I think that when you're thinking about benefits, you want to also examine some of the potential harms. Now, to date, there have been no documented harms associated with the use of sunscreen.
Mm-hmm. So there's no harm, so no foul. You're better off using it than not.
So I would say that if you want to use it for preventing sunburns, for anti-aging, etc., and you're of color, fine. But if you think that using it is going to lower your risk of melanoma, then there is no evidence to suggest that.
How is melanoma usually diagnosed?
Melanoma is usually diagnosed either the patient recognizes a mole that's growing or bleeding or hurts, and they present to their doctor, and they get a biopsy, and that biopsy is read by a pathologist, and they make a diagnosis of melanoma.
What does it look like in somebody, say, like Bob Marley, who got it in his toenail? What does that look like?
So usually it looks like a really dark kind of pigmented bump, you know, or it can even be a streak along longitudinally along the nail that grows over time. It can actually start, you know, start bleeding and changing different colors if it's left undiagnosed for a long time.
The rates have risen in the last 30 years. The melanoma rates have risen in the last 30 years. Is that for both white and non-white?
So it is both for white versus non-white. There has been an increase in the amount of melanomas that we diagnose in the non-white population. But that increase is way faster in the white population.
Go ahead. What do we know about why that might be?
We're not exactly sure 100% why that is. One reason is UV exposure, right? We have more people using tanning beds. We have more people going out and you know, tanning on the beach, and that certainly is part of the increase. And we're also finding more than we have before.
Better
reporting. We're biopsying, you know, more melanomas. We're screening people, and so all of these factors can contribute to the increase in the amount of melanoma that's being diagnosed over time.
For people of color who are more liable to get the acral melanoma, do they Are they getting diagnosed at the same comparable rates? Or is it getting caught? Are the survival rates comparable to whites?
That's a great question. So the survival rates for whites is a lot higher than it is for blacks. So when black folks get diagnosed with melanoma, it's often at later stages. And as you know, you may know, diagnosis of any cancer at a later stage usually means a worse prognosis, right? And so, you know, what I, you know, want to get out there is that black people, you know, or people of color are at risk for skin cancers like melanoma, but they need to be aware, you know, and check their palms of their hands, soles of their feet, for anything that's changing. And if they notice anything amiss, they need to go and see a board-certified dermatologist for evaluation.
Outside of the melanoma rates, what about basal and squamous cell cancer? Is that diagnosed? Are there diagnosing differences between race and ethnicity on that score as well?
Yeah. So usually in darker skin types, basal cell cancers, they're darker, they're pigmented, whereas in white folks, they're usually pink bumps. So they can look a bit differently. And squamous cell cancers, they can appear as, you know, wounds that just aren't healing. And they can also be kind of dark and flaky in darker skin types, where they're, you know, more pink and red in lighter skin populations.
So people kind of blow it off a little more easily with darker skins. They don't.
Yeah.
It doesn't get their attention as fast.
Yeah, and I think it's because, in part, people don't think that they're at risk of developing skin cancer. Everyone is at risk of developing skin cancer at different rates, obviously, but it's still possible. And you don't want to blow off, you know, a wound that's not healing or a bump that is growing or changing colors, no matter the color of your skin.
As far as you know, treatment for melanoma, how treatable is it, and does it differ between the acral melanoma that's more common in blacks than from the melanoma that's more common in whites?
So the treatment for melanoma is typically driven by how deep the melanoma has gone in the skin.
Okay.
Right? For most melanomas, the initial treatment is surgery. Now, if the depth of the melanoma is pretty shallow, so if you've caught it early, all you really need is surgery, no matter if it's an acral melanoma or a superficial spreading melanoma. But if those melanomas get to a certain depth, then that may require further surgery, lymph node biopsies, and if it's gone to other places in the body, that might require chemotherapy and some of the latest treatments, which are immunotherapy.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about, is how it spreads. It seems so different than organ-based cancers.
So it can spread either through the lymph drainage system, right? That's one way in which it can spread. Or it can, if it grows enough and connects with the blood supply of the rest of your body, it can travel through the blood and, you know, to other parts like the brain or the liver. Are two very common sites of metastasis, is what they call it, when it moves to other parts of the body.
Right. Dr. Adamson, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoy talking to you.
Adi Adamson is a board-certified dermatologist and assistant professor of internal medicine at the University of Texas at Austin. He recently wrote about the issue of melanoma in blacks versus how it presents in whites. For the conversation, we'll post a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Bedtimes for children, young and old, is more fluid in the summer. But when school starts, things have to change. Dr. Marcus Schmidt is the president and director of research at the Ohio Sleep Medicine Institute. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be on with you.
What do we know about how much sleep patterns change between summer and fall for kids?
Well, it's a big change, actually. You know, kids have a tendency anyways, especially the teenagers, to have a little bit later bedtime, stay up late. It's sunny until, you know, 10 o'clock at night practically. So people tend to go to bed late. And they have a natural tendency anyways to want to sleep in. And so this tends to be a pretty big shift that happens as we hit summer for the kids.
We've talked on the show in the past about, you know, some school districts changing times, particularly for older students who have that tendency to want to sleep in the morning. As you say, it's kind of a natural tendency, and they're addressing it that way. How can we artificially address it when it comes to bedtimes?
Well, you know, you hit on a point, actually. It's important to understand. I don't know if really people understand this enough. You know, we have a clock that's in our brain. It's an internal, we call it the circadian clock, and it really sets the timing of, you know, when we want to go to bed and when to get up in the morning. And this clock is not exactly 24 hours long. It's actually a little bit more than 24 hours. And when we hit puberty, for whatever reason, we don't really understand that, there is this slowing down of the clock. And so kids naturally, as they hit puberty, want to sleep in. They want to stay up later. And so they have this, again, very important natural tendency to want to make a shift. And so as we make it this, you know, in school, we have it in our country that kids, when they go from primary to secondary school, they go earlier, so they're shifting their school time completely in the opposite direction as to what their internal clock is naturally telling them, and so it can be a big shock for them to move or advance the clock, if you will, to get up early enough in the morning, and for that matter, to go to sleep early enough. And so we recommend, you know, as kids are going through this summer where they're really sleeping late typically, is that you gradually shift the bedtime, you know, 15 minutes perhaps per evening to go bed earlier each night and get up earlier. So shifting the wake-up time so that by the time school starts, it's not a shock anymore. They're really ready to go.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about bedtimes for kids now that school started. My guest is Dr. Marcus Schmidt. He's president and director of research at Ohio Sleep Medicine Institute. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When do you think parents need to start easing their kids into a routine change?
Well, you know, it depends a bit about, I mean, you know your kid, and some kids, you know, we all, I should say, all of us tend to be evening types or morning types. You know, we have our own what we call chronotype. And if you are an evening chronotype to begin with, and you're just really, have that type of tendency to be going to bed so late, you're going to have to start a little earlier. And so typically, we recommend, you know, about 2 weeks before to start. But again, some kids are, you know, if they're more of a morning type to begin with, they may not need so much of a time to make the transition.
Yeah. What do we know about the impact if they don't get enough sleep?
Well, I think, you know, we all intuitively know a bit about that. As if we don't get our sleep, we don't function as well. But it's can have big impact. You know, we know that these early school times, for example, that there's quite a bit of research that has been done showing that, you know, kids who are at the early school programs as a group tend not to do as well with their grades as kids who go to school that have a later start time, for example. And it's really interesting. This is we talk about this clock that we have in all of us. And it was just a couple of years ago, actually, that the Nobel Prize in Medicine went to three researchers who were responsible for really discovering how this molecular clock actually works. And we're beginning to understand so much more about, you know, how this clock impacts many of the functions that happen, you know, at the cellular level. You know, when do you do protein synthesis and when you do things that your body needs to do, repair your cell membranes, for example. But there are other functions that we do in sleep or wake. And so there are state-dependent functions and clock-dependent functions. And when both of those are aligned nicely, the clock and the state, meaning sleep and wake, everything works great and everybody's happy. But when there's a misalignment, you know, you start early because you have to be at school, but your internal clock wants to still be asleep. Now you have a misalignment, and you're just not going to be functioning as well. You're not going to be thinking as quickly. Your reaction times are longer, etc. So it has a big impact.
Is the rule of 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night the same for kids as it is for adults?
Actually, it changes quite considerably as we age, right? So the 7 to 8 hours is basically what we've long said for adults. But, you know, infants need 14 to 17 hours a night. And as you get into the toddler range, you're about 11 to 14. These are recommendations, by the way, that are available by the National Sleep Foundation. They have on the it's a very nice site for people who are interested. They show at which age group the amount of recommended sleep most kids or people need at that age group. And then for school age, meaning, you know, 6 to 13-year-olds, it's basically 9 to 11 hours of sleep are what most kids need. But, you know, most are not getting that. And teenagers, they recommend 8 to 10 hours per night. And, you know, for any of us who've had teenagers, we know that that's typically not well respected.
And we're so jealous of them because if we could just go to bed at 9 or 10 o'clock, we'd be happy. youth is wasted on the young, as they say. Is there a way to catch up on sleep over the weekend? Can you say, oh, I'll just let them sleep in on Saturday? Not that my parents ever did, but...
Yeah, so it actually you can a little bit, but then you've got it's a double-edged sword, mm-hmm. right? So if the problem is if you sleep in and if you're one of these binge sleepers, you know, on the weekend, you get up, you know, 4 hours or more later than what you normally do, and you do that, you know, 2 days in a row, you know, you have now reset that internal clock, right? So getting up instead of at 6 in the morning like you normally do, now you're getting up at 10 in the morning or noon. Your internal clock for 2 days has shifted. And typically what happens is that come Sunday night, you know, you're not going to be able to get to sleep. You go to bed when you're supposed to, even if you, you know, do go to bed when you're supposed to. You're going to, you know, tend to lie there. They can't fall asleep because now their clock is shifted. I tell some of my student patients, you know, you've gone to Hawaii for the weekend. You know, it's nice being in Hawaii, but now you got to come back to Ohio on Sunday, and you got to get to bed. And the problem is that these kids, you know, they have to be up on Monday morning for school, and so they typically start the week behind the eight ball. Right off the block, they are now sleep deprived, and they've got a sleep debt that they start the week off. And you can imagine as you go through the week, you accumulate that debt, and now on the weekend, you're in a vicious cycle again. You pay it back, sleep in on the weekends, reset the clock, and have trouble the next week again. So you get into this vicious cycle that it's sometimes difficult to get out of.
How does technology and the blue light that from it factor into all of this these days?
It's a big problem. You know, I think many people, including the adults in the room, probably tend to, you know, read, you know, on their iPhone or their phone or their tablet before they go to sleep. And as it's a in society now, this is a big problem. And that light that's emitted from these devices has typically a blue range. And it turns out that it is particularly the blue range of light that our retina picks up. And it communicates to the clock in the brain that, you know, it's daytime. It's not time to go to sleep. And it prevents the natural release of melatonin. And that melatonin at night is important to help us fall asleep, but also to set the hands of the clock. It actually is important for setting the timing of the clock. It's a big problem. And I tell, you know, my patients as much as possible, have an unplugged hour before you go to sleep. You know, do some reading with a dim light mm-hmm. or lower intensity light, and that can potentially help.
Can you take melatonin artificially and maybe give yourself a boost there?
The question, of course, is that really the optimal way to manage somebody long term? There's questions. Most consider, melatonin to be relatively safe, mm-hmm. Especially low doses. But, we don't know in developing kids, whether it's something we want to do long term. It should be, maybe I would recommend avoiding that if you can, because there really are better ways to manage this. And I think that, one of the things that I look at is particularly on the weekend is to, instruct the kids, get up, maybe sleep in at most an hour than what you normally do. But if you go beyond that, the more you go beyond that, the more you risk resetting the clock and getting into trouble. So you can use other techniques.
Okay. So a sleep in an hour, that's okay. Other than that,
it may depend, right?
I mean,
there's some people are their natural clock is so much delayed that even an hour may be too much for them, and others it may be fine. So you have to kind of tailor this to the individual. But generally speaking, I don't get too worried if it's maybe an hour or so. But, you just really want to minimize that.
Are there any other tools in the toolbox for this as far as sleeping? I've heard about like sound machines, white noise, that kind of a thing that helps some people sleep.
Yeah, some people, whatever technique you use, just remember it becomes your new pillow, right? I mean, do we really need to have covers? Maybe not if the temperature of the room is nice. It's that we feel comforted by whatever we go to sleep with.
Okay.
And if you use white noise, it becomes in some ways, your new pillow. And what I recommend is that, if that helps you, I would recommend really using white noise, whether it's a fan, sort of a water, music, television in the background, mm-hmm. radio is not helpful because, our brain is wired to really identify changes in sound or light, and that can be alerting. And so as much as possible, those kind of stimuli from the background noise should be avoided.
And as far as getting kids back into a healthy sleep routine, any ideas for young kids? Because they're the ones that are going to actually listen to what you say anyway. So let's just shoot for that. Let's be realistic. You got a third grader who's, just been, doing campfires every night all summer and staying up late. How do you kind of start easing them back into it without traumatizing them?
Well, one thing that can be really helpful is establishing, particularly at these younger ages, establishing a bedtime routine, reading a story, mm-hmm. Spending some time with your child, going to sit in bed, that can be very a positive type of reinforcement. And so that can be very, really particularly helpful. Mm-hmm. And do that on a regular basis, and especially as you get closer to the start of school and as those 2 weeks, it can really help sort of, ease them back into the earlier schedule and getting to bed earlier.
Is there a good way to wake up a kid?
good question. Some use water,
There's a scene from Malcolm in the Middle that I'd like to... that I always remember, but pulling the mattress out from under him. But anyways,
for example, no, I think if you do the bedtime right, mm-hmm. you know, that's the key, right? If you get into this routine, getting up in the morning becomes so much easier, right? Because your internal clock begins to anticipate when the wake up time is. All right, and so if you establish the routine, the wake up time just almost naturally and typically gets established and is really not a problem. So, you know, I think some people get worried about, you know, trying to, you know, overstimulate and so forth. I mean, I recommend just really, you know, being as gentle as you need to be. Mm-hmm. But if you, you know, the school starts, you've got to get that bus. Mm-hmm. You know, it really becomes, if it becomes that much of an issue, you know, it's where you have to sit down and say, okay, let's look at our schedule. What are we doing wrong?
Given the state of affairs, given the technology that's out there and ubiquitous now almost, given the schedules that we're forced to live with every day, and granted, all of this stuff we can change, but what about the idea of naps? How do you feel about that?
So, you know, a brief nap, if you really need it, you know, you've got a major, you got, you know, a test or something, and you're really tired. You know, a brief nap can actually be quite helpful for your performance for that day. The problem is that you know we build up this sleep pressure, right? That pressure is built up during the day, and that is what naturally helps us fall asleep at night. And so if you relieve too much of that pressure during the day, your nap is maybe more than 20 minutes, maybe it's an hour long. Well, now you're really in trouble, because typically you're going to have that much more difficulty getting to sleep at night, and you get back into this vicious cycle problem again. And so you have to be careful. I recommend, really, if you need a nap, it should be, if possible, 15, 20 minutes, but really avoid doing something longer.
And then exercise. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, there's no question. I mean, the data is pretty clear. The exercise does help consolidate sleep. You know, our deep sleep, for example, tends to be a bit more enhanced in particular. The problem is that you want to avoid doing the exercise, you know, close to bedtime, mm-hmm. right? I mean, one of the things that happens just as natural physiology is that as we go to sleep, or we get even before we go to sleep, you know, the half hour to the hour before we're actually going to bed, our body temperature is already decreasing. And we have a natural body temperature rhythm. And as our body temperature decreases, on that downward slope of the temperature is when that sleep gate opens, if you will, and we tend to be able to sleep. And so if you exercise too close to bedtime, then your body temperature is not decreasing, it's rising, or it's maybe still on the upswing, and that's going to hinder your ability to get to sleep. And so close to bedtime, you want to avoid exercising.
Dr. Marcus Schmidt, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
That's Dr. Marcus Schmidt. He's president and director of research for the Ohio Sleep Medicine Institute. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Mental health professionals and the people they treat want to change the conversations surrounding suicide, depression, and other mental health issues in the U.S. To help achieve this, Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health will kick off its first ever Wonderbus Music and Arts Festival this weekend in Columbus. The festival is intended to benefit mental health programs at Ohio State, and it was created with the goal of changing changing the conversation. Dr. Luan Fan is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Ohio State. He joins us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the festival and why you think this is a good idea.
Well, it's a phenomenal opportunity to raise awareness around mental illness, and particularly depression and suicide. We have an opportunity here to raise awareness and also to stimulate conversation and dialogue around these very important and pressing matters of our time in our society. And, you know, to me, it's a unique chance to link music, which is a very universal vehicle where musicians tie melodies and lyrics that motivate and touch people in terms of sharing life experiences and stories. And we all know that music listeners often gravitate towards the kind of music that speaks to them on a personal level. And we've heard many, many personal stories that music has sort of changed their lives and taken it to a more positive direction because of the connectedness or the relatedness that they feel with the music. So I think that it's a great vehicle and an avenue for us as mental health professionals to link with something that's so universal. And certainly mental health is very universal as well.
How is the festival curated? Who decided who's going to perform and that kind of a thing? What were you shooting for?
Well, I mean, I think that on the festival side, certainly there were partners that came up with the schedule and the list of musicians. Mm-hmm. I really want to particularly highlight the Elevation Group and the Shipyard, who really came together to highlight mental illness and shed a light on this important issue. I'm not particularly, sure that the musicians themselves will raise awareness, but we hope that they do through different platforms during the 2 days of the festival.
Right. So if I go to the festival, what am I going to see? What am I going to hear? How's it formatted?
Yeah, so the festival is a music festival on Saturday and Sunday. Our department will have a booth dedicated to raising awareness and giving really practical tips to music and concert goers about how to best address and raise the conversation. And in the case that they know someone who's struggling with depression and having thoughts of suicide, and what are the next steps to help the individual. We have a kind of a tagline, La La La. It stands for Listen and Ask, Love and Act, Link and Advocate, in terms of La La La, to sort of then translate that to very practical tips on how to handle and approach someone who's struggling.
People don't know what to do, right? They just don't know.
Yes, it's certainly an uncomfortable topic from both the person suffering from depression and other mental struggles and emotional issues, but also the person listening to them, the friend, the loved one, the family member who's sort of being engaged in this conversation and sharing this story can be quite uncomfortable and certainly both concerning and unnerving at the same time. So we sort of believe that practical tips are really useful in this regard.
Are there some demographics that are more at risk for suffering from something like depression, severe depression, suicidal thoughts than others?
No, I mean, I think that depression, suicidal thoughts, anxiety, addiction, kind of the major issues in mental health, cut across all demographic lines from old to young, across ethnicities and races, and across all socioeconomic realms. And so it's pretty widespread. The data show that women are more susceptible to depression and anxiety than men, but those numbers, the gap is closing by the day. And certainly anxiety can manifest very early in childhood as well. So it tends to be, for many people, a lifelong struggle.
Women are more susceptible to it, but women are also tend to seek help for it more readily, right?
That's right. Historically, women have been more open and willing to use the right terms when they approach a professional, whether it's a doctor or a counselor, that would then signal someone that they're suffering from depression, whereas men have tended to use words that are more physical in nature that sort of obscures an underlying emotional issue, and I think that's part of the issue. There might be some biological underpinnings between the sex and gender differences as well.
If you suspect a family member or a close friend is suffering from mental health issues, how do you even start a conversation with them?
Well, I mean, I think, as I said, with the la-la-la idea, the first thing is to start by listening and asking questions. I think that both listening and asking questions in a non-judgmental and empathic way shows love and caring, and that helps the individual in two ways. It helps them open up more, and secondly, it gives them evidence that someone really cares and is part of their network of support to lean on. So I think those two first steps are really critical. And I think in terms of suicide, it's important to explicitly ask about, are you thinking about killing yourself, about harming yourself? Because the data and the research show that asking actually reduces suicide rather than increases it. And I think that's been a myth out there in the past, that by asking about suicide, you might give someone the idea of suicide, but that's certainly not what the research has shown consistently.
It's uncomfortable, though, to ask that question.
It's very uncomfortable, but yet very important, because you, at that time, are the main sort of barrier to someone carrying out the act. And so you want to ask about that thought and that intent, and also if the person has thought about a way to do it, a method, and doing your best to sort of put both time and barriers between the person who's struggling from their method of choice or their method that they're thinking about. But, you know, so I think it's scary, but I think it is also really important.
Does the research show that if I were to ask somebody, are you thinking about harming yourself, that they would tell the truth?
Yes, the research suggests that the more we ask, the more people tend to open up and to share, because it's on their mind. And so it's important that we as empathic listeners say that it's an important thing that we're willing to listen and help and act on their behalf as well. So I think it's going to stimulate them opening up more rather than shutting down the conversation.
What are some... So how might one know when it's time to do more than listen and ask, that is, help somebody get professional treatment?
Yeah, I think if the person is isolating themselves, if they're struggling in school or in relationships and struggling at work where it's causing dysfunction in life, I think those are trigger points. Mm-hmm. I also think that other trigger points are if someone is feeling despair and hopelessness, that it's important to engage help as well. The important thing to note is that we know that when the condition is recognized and the person seeks treatment, treatments are known to work. We have plenty of available treatments in terms of not only medications, but also talk therapy. Both have been shown to reduce anxiety, depression, and suicide.
You know, you say that, but a lot of people might say back to you, well, it's hard to find a good psychiatrist that you don't have to schedule out 4 to 6 months in advance. It's hard to find a good talk therapist, particularly for adolescent boys, for instance.
No, I think you're right. There's certainly a shortage of providers out there, particularly psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, adolescent psychiatrists in our communities. And so access is a struggle for our field. But I think that getting the initial referral out, most places will do their best to triage and ascertain the level of severity of the patient to get them to the right treatment at the right time, at the right place, be it in the emergency room, in a crisis center, or in the outpatient or inpatient setting. So it's important to take that first step and not necessarily worry about access right away, though that's something that our field and certain our institution is working very hard to solve in terms of both growing the number of people in the workforce, but also developing novel ways to get to people sooner in a more efficient and effective way.
Are there disparities when it comes to treatment, say, about minority mental health treatment, disparities between racial groups, ethnic groups, economic groups?
Absolutely. There's certainly a racial and socioeconomic disparity in terms of having the resources to access treatment and get treatment. Also in terms of the availability of treatments as well, there's a disparity there.
Which reminds me, we're going to be talking about that disparity tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Listeners, and then the stigma. Is the stigma at this point in the process of our societal evolution, is it a generational thing? Is it a gender thing? Is it an ethnic thing? Where is the stigma? Where does it take root and why does it persist? What do we know about that?
Yeah, I think it's all of those things, to be frank. So it's not a straightforward answer. Mm-hmm. I think that depending on the group, you know, I think that in general, in one group might be more vulnerable to the stigma than another, which is the sense that if you have a mental illness, be it depression, anxiety, addiction, or any other mental illness, there's a lot of shame associated with it. And most of people who are suffering are often in the shadows and are sort of kept in the shadows and marginalized. And therefore, it's very hard to share the struggle with someone else, especially when the person feels the shame and sort of blames themselves for getting into depression, anxiety, or addiction in the first place. And they often think it's mistakenly think that it's their own fault and that their will is weak or their cognitive or emotional strength is weak, and that's why they feel these things, and they don't consider it as a true medical illness like any other medical illness, be it diabetes or heart disease or cancer.
You know, when it comes to this festival this weekend, the Wonderbus Music and Arts Festival, and what your hopes are for it, how are you going to measure the success of the festival? What are you looking for?
I think our goal is simple, which is to stimulate the conversation. The more that people talk about it, the more they'll be able to raise awareness around the importance and the prevalence of these conditions and how each and every one of us, either ourselves or our family members and loved ones, suffer. And by doing so, by raising the conversation, it would stimulate increased access and resources to the area. And that's something that we really, really need to sort of allocate and have parity in mental health access and treatment like we focus on other major medical conditions that, you know, that plague patients. You know, I think just to put it into plain numbers, I think that's the other thing that we want to share and spread awareness about. So, you know, obviously it's better to talk about really concrete numbers rather than percentages or millions of people. But I would say if you gathered any four people at the concert and together, one in four of those people in the last year have suffered from depression and anxiety, and another one of those four have suffered from addiction to alcohol and other substances. So it's a pretty prevalent problem. If you think about suicide in the last latest numbers, almost 130 people die by suicide each day, every day of the year. And so those are really alarming numbers as a major public health concern. And so as we begin to share the stories and spread those numbers, we hope that it will bring greater awareness, but then ultimately more resources to improve access and better treatments for patients.
Dr. Fahn, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate your time and being able to stimulate the dialogue.
Dr. Luam Phan is chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, which is one of the sponsors of the inaugural Wonder Bus Music and Arts Festival this weekend in Columbus. We'll post a link to a website where you can learn more about the festival at allsides at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.